Hey everyone, I'm excited to introduce today's guest, Liat Hayoun. Liat is the CEO and co-founder at Eureka Security, a cloud data security company based in Tel Aviv. Liat was the VP of product management at Palo Alto Networks before starting Eureka in 2021. Our conversation details her journey behind running and managing an early seed stage cyber startup, and I really had a great time meeting Liat and hope you guys enjoy the conversation as well.
Well, the party is off to a good start.
Liat, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining me today. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, of course. Well, as a way to kick us off, I'd love to start with a little bit of context and some background. So could you please tell us a little bit about how you found your way into the world of cybersecurity?
Of course. So for the last 2 years, I've had the pleasure of being the CEO of Eureka Security, which we'll talk a bit about more a bit later. But before joining Eureka, before starting Eureka, I was a part of Palo Alto Networks for 6 years, being a part of different product management teams across different product areas. And the way I got into Palo Alto Networks is actually very common when you think about the journey that many Israelis do within the Israeli iTech ecosystem. I actually spent the first decade of my career within the IDF, and more specifically within the intelligence corps of the IDF, where I already basically started working on cybersecurity-related projects since I was 21. So that's all I've ever known is cybersecurity.
Got it. Okay. And I'd love to maybe better understand sort of the background or some context for how you, like what led to you starting Eureka. So what were maybe some of the inflection points or moments throughout, your time in the IDF and your time at Palo Alto that made you want to make the jump into entrepreneurship?
Of course. So when you think about, or when I think about the journey that I've been through, it's always been around interesting stuff to do, great people to do that with, and significant problems to solve for. That's actually how I got into cybersecurity to begin with. That's how I found my way into product management and into Palo Alto Networks. And as I was working on different cybersecurity related projects and talking to other friends of mine in different industries, I realized that the problem of cloud and data and the combination of those two things is something that is imminent and that many organizations are starting to struggle with that. So on one hand, the cloud obviously brings a ton of opportunities. The reason we're seeing so many startups is because, you know, you don't need to now buy a data center and build all the infrastructure on your own. The cloud has enabled so much more innovation. Now, when you combine that with what we're seeing today with just data and data science and artificial intelligence and machine learning and all these great capabilities that have existed for a while now, but has now become more and more common, you get to a situation where almost any organization is highly motivated to store enormous amounts of data within their cloud infrastructure. That's just a combination of these two revolutions we're seeing, the data revolution, the cloud one. Now, with this flexibility and enablement that the cloud provides, it also creates a lot of risk. Flexibility is great when you're an engineer, but when you're a security person, the fact that your engineering team has a lot of flexibility in terms of where to store data, how to move it around the infrastructure, who to provide access to, that becomes concerning. So really what we wanted to focus on is helping organizations manage that balance between providing the business the ability to leverage the data and to move forward with innovation, but on the other hand, maintain the needed guardrails around that data and making sure that all of our data is secure while it's stored within these organizations' infrastructure.
Yeah. And what were some of the maybe signals you saw at Palo Alto and at IDF that, you know, I kind of personally made you say, all right, you know, I recognize this as a problem and I'm going to be the one that's going to go start a company to solve it.
Yeah. So I think that what you're looking for is, or for me at least, it was three types of signals. So the first one, I felt this problem firsthand. Palo Alto Networks, being a great data-driven cybersecurity company, leverages a lot of data to be able to create new products, to identify new threats. So I saw firsthand how difficult it was and how challenging it was for an organization that takes the security of that data very seriously to allow that data to be used within the organization. So that's kind of from a firsthand experience. The second thing I've noticed is that there were no good solutions for it back then. So there was no way to manage that without creating a lot of processes, without slowing down the movement of data and the free access to data when needed. And then the third part, and that has happened already once I started to dive deeper into this space and better understand not just my perspective, but other organizations, was that it's something that is becoming more and more common in more and more industries. And this is really what I was kind of not just looking for, but really excited about, that there's this significant challenge, significant both in terms of the level of pain, but also in terms of the breadth of how common it is, that with solving this, not only I can protect organizations and me and my company can help protect organizations, but also enable them to operate in a way that would really drive more innovation. So that was that third indicator that we've found as we started our validation process towards this idea.
Yeah. And what was, like, what did that validation process look like for you guys?
Basically talking to anyone that was willing to talk to us. It started out, obviously, again, with just our own personal experiences, our own personal connections, starting to dive more and more into this world. And at the same time, of course, doing our own analysis of the market and the existing tooling to see what is already out there and whether or not there are any existing solutions. And if so, what are the shortcomings of these solutions? And then as we expanded the scope and started working together with Wild Ventures, who is our lead investor, we've obviously were able to now increase our reach and talk to many more organizations. I think when we came out of stealth about 6 months after we raised our seed round, we realized that we talked to dozens, if not a couple of hundreds, of different teams and within different organizations, different types of people, different roles within the organization, just to make sure that it's not a fluke. We're actually onto something. There's actually a significant enough pain point for teams to want to work with us to solve this problem.
Yeah. And I'm curious, as you had those conversations, you know, with prospective customers, just others to validate whether or not this was a problem they were experiencing and a problem worth solving or not, what were some things you learned that were surprising? Was there anything that maybe you weren't expecting as you went into those and, you know, had those hundreds or dozens of conversations?
So I think the first thing we learned is that again, coming from a very security-oriented company, what we thought is we're solving an agility problem. Everyone protect their data as much as they can. And what happens is that the business is slowing down. And what we realized, especially when you think about the growth of companies and how quickly organizations grew, is that a lot of organizations are actually also struggling on that other edge of the spectrum, which means that they actually do allow data to be used quite freely and just lost the ability to control how that is now being managed in the organization. So if you think about this trade-off between protecting the data, slowing down the business, or allowing the data to be used, but creating that security concern, our first kind of perspective, again, given our experience, was that we'll find more organizations on that first side of the spectrum. And again, now with 2 years of experience into this, I'm not surprised that we found more organizations on the other side of that spectrum, just because we know the business is stronger than anything else. And again, especially with organizations growing from a couple of people to hundreds of people in a startup, for example, that means that the ability to control anything was minimal, right? Everything just exploded in terms of growth and speed of innovation. So very early on, that was very surprising to us. I think secondly is we thought that, when you start the validation process, you don't know what signals to look for, but when you know, like you can see when there's a level of excitement about the problem space you're talking about or about the solution you're proposing. And it's like, initially we thought, how would we know when we're onto something? And very early on, it's like, okay, we know it's that.
Yeah. Did you see the message resonating more in certain, you know, sort of demographics or certain types of companies, like, you know, more cloud native organizations versus, you know, large, I'll say traditional enterprises, for example?
Yes, definitely. So again, if even intuitively, I'm guessing that most of the listeners understand that when we talk about protecting data in the cloud, it's a combination of two things, right? You need to be in the cloud. So that means that if you're a very traditional industry that have not gone through the migration to the cloud yet, with your data specifically, then the problem we're talking about is not yet there. If you need to talk to the DBA every time you want a copy of your data, then you have the ability to control where data is going to and who has access to it. So the cloud piece is definitely a critical one. And then alongside that, there's the data piece, which is, does the organization have or stores sensitive data by definition? So industries that are more relevant for this are healthcare and financial institutions, insurance, and so on. That being said, we, again, 2 years into the process, we realized that every organization has some data they consider sensitive. It might not be regulatory data, so the drivers to protect it might be a bit different when you think about the balance between compliance and risk and cybersecurity risk. But almost every organization we talk to has some data they want to protect. So those are the two things that are most critical. And then, of course, I would say the other factor would be the size of the organization. I always say that Eureka Security would probably not be a good Eureka Security customer, just because we're still a very young and small company, which means that, you know, for dozens of people in the organization, you can still assume some level of control. When the engineering organization becomes hundreds of people, that's where the lack of control is starting to be more critical.
Yeah. You know, when you think back on sort of the story with Eureka thus far, what are some things that maybe you know now that you wish you knew on day one or day zero of starting the company?
Oof, there's so many things you want to learn day one. So I think what we knew and we can always do better is as much customer friction as possible as early as possible. So we knew that early on, but I think you can even go more aggressive with that, both in terms of how many different organizations you talk to, how early do you want them to be running any piece of your code, even the very initial proof of concept. So there's looking back, I think there's more we could have done to be more aggressive, to go forward even faster than we thought. The second piece is we assumed that for many organizations, a single cloud would starting with a single cloud would be enough. And I think we didn't realize how, even for smaller organizations, you wouldn't imagine how small you can get and still have like 2.5 different data storage technologies, whether if it's public cloud or data warehouses and so on. So I think, again, that if we could have gone back in time, we could have identified that sooner, we'd be able to even work with more organizations as we kicked off. So I think those are kind of the two learnings we took out of that.
Yeah. I'm always curious to ask founders and CEOs about risk, and specifically, like, in your frame of mind, sort of your relationship with risk or how you've thought about risk as, you know, when you were going through the early considerations of starting the company. Like, for example, you know, you're being at Palo Alto Networks and, you know, obviously a very successful, sustainable company. How do you think about, or how did you go through the mental exercise of thinking, all right, I'm going to take a risk here of working with co-founders and starting a business? Or did you not consider it too much of a risk because you had so much conviction? So what was sort of your mindset there?
So I think the mindset actually changes between the two examples you gave almost on a daily basis. I, early on, I had a great career at Palo Alto Networks and I spent about 6 years being there. So I think for me, it was more around, it felt like the right timing to take the next step. And whether or not the next step would be successfully launching a startup or spending 6 months trying to talk to organizations, to do some ideation or validation, and maybe that's it. I was pretty okay with that. So I kind of knew myself and my co-founder herself, we kind of knew worst case scenario, this would be 6-12 months of fun working together, better understanding areas within cybersecurity that we weren't as familiar with before. And, you know, we'll see what comes out of it. So I think actually that just leaving Palo Alto Networks and starting that process was actually not as scary as the day that we've raised our seed round and hired our first employees. Because I think up until that point, it was just, you know, just the two of us. We knew what we were getting into. We were only wasting our own time, basically. We weren't responsible for anyone else's money or anyone else's career. And at that point, it was kind of, you know, we were having fun. We were learning a lot. We were spending a lot of time together. I think what really, and it's, you know, it's only looking back that I realized that, because I thought, you know, the bungee jump is the minute you decide to tell everyone you're going to start, you leave your previous job and you tell everyone you're going to start something. But I think the actual bungee jump is when you sign those C documents and you bring on your first hires, because that's when it becomes real, right? That's where you can say, oh, this was fun for 6 months. I'm going to go back and find myself a new job. This is where you're actually the CEO of an actual company. And it's been a crazy ride since then, but that's kind of led to that for me. I didn't consider that as the riskiest part of the journey, but I think that was that moment in time.
Sure. Yeah. I can imagine it's, you know, that initial decision, it's almost freeing, right? Where we think, all right, we can take a few months and if this works out, wonderful. If not, exactly. We'll be okay. But then as soon as, you know, like you said, there's employees and other considerations, it's a different type of risk. So, exactly. How do you kind of manage that today? You know, I'm sure it's things like working hard and ensuring you're like doing the best you can to increase the value of the business and outcomes for employees. But how do you just think about that or manage that today?
So I think for me, it's two things. So one is what you said. I want to be true to myself, to know that at any given point in time, I'm doing everything I can for the success of the company and the success of my team. So I feel like, you know, obviously we're geared to success and we're kind of eyes on the prize and we know where we're headed. But I want to be confident, to know that whatever happens, I did my best for the company. And then the second piece is providing visibility and being very transparent with the team, especially at this stage where about 20 people come, 20 people across the world, around the both in Tel Aviv and the U.S. So it's still, everything is still very intimate. Everyone still knows what's going on. And I think that level of transparency of, you know, what works, what doesn't work, what are we hearing from customers, what can we do better? Not only it helps me personally to get more thoughts into the process, to get more ideas and more people involved in how we can make things better, but it also provides me the assurance of, you know, people are following me and my co-founder because they believe in us, but also because they know what's going on and they know the direction we're headed. They know what we're going to do to get there. And it provides me more, you know, it's just more assurance that, you know, not only I believe in what we do, I have this amazing team that also believes in us. So, you know, it's that much more, it gives me that much more confidence in what to do. Like I hired an amazing team, all smarter than me. So if those people think what we're doing is right, I'm on the right track.
What have been maybe some of the biggest things you've learned over the last period of time since starting Eureka?
I think this is, I think maybe just to be very, very blunt, we're Israeli, so we don't tend to be very, very polite. I think the one thing that is not being said enough and probably should be said more, especially for aspiring entrepreneurs, is that this is more difficult than it looks like, right? Everyone like to post their successes and talk about what works well. And that's awesome. Obviously, we do the same. But I think the one thing I learned is that the day-to-day is, you know, it is very much of a roller coaster. And while you publicize the highs of those roller coaster paths, there's also a lot of difficult times. But mm-hmm. What I learned alongside that is that there's also a great community that is eager to help, fellow entrepreneurs just because they want to help without asking for anything in return. So I found that sense of community, the ability to share the highs and lows, the ability to talk to people that have been or are in the same journey, has been very, for us, it's been extremely helpful, both on a kind of day-to-day questions and how we should operate, what should we take into account when making the next decision, but also just to provide that, that level of comfort, that empathy of, you know, this is unique what we're going through, but it's not as unique to what you think, right? It's not like everyone are doing amazingly and you're the only one struggling, and vice versa. If something is going well, how to make sure it continues and not just, you know, it's not you're not done. So I think that's
I'm right there with you.
Learn though, right? I think one of the things that we keep forgetting is that entrepreneurs come from a specific background, whether if it's sales or marketing or product or engineering. But then all of a sudden, you also need to learn to do all these other things, to manage a budget and to look at marketing campaigns and to hire people you've never hired for these functions before. So in terms of actual learning, there's so much to learn on a day-to-day basis. But just that sense of community, I think, for me is the most probably the most important thing right now.
Yeah. No, I'm very much with you on that. And, you know, despite what people post on LinkedIn, it's rarely just straight up and to the right. you mentioned the sense of community and, you know, having a backstop, if you will, of just people you can trust to, you know, help you through that. How else do you manage, you know, the ups and the downs, right? Because some days can be phenomenal, other days may not be as good. So what are things you do to kind of manage that?
Yeah. So, you know, we talked about community. I think it's a lot about, there's the external factors and who mm-hmm. you surround yourself with. So for me, again, it's Asaf, my co-founder. Asaf and I have been really good friends for 15 years before founding Eureka. I know some people build great companies with people who they met through, you know, I would say even throughout the entrepreneurship journey. But for me, I don't know, I can't imagine going through this experience without someone who I fully trust and feel very comfortable with. And then on the other side is, of course, my family, my partner. Deciding to build a company is not something you decide on your own and then just announce. It's something that, for me at least, we decided on together, both on the timing and kind of what would that require. So family, friends, my co-founder are definitely a huge part of who I rely on to manage the ups and downs. And then just from an internal perspective, I think it's a lot of self-work, you know, just understanding what's going on, not taking things too personally. It's very hard to do so. It's very easy to say. But for at least for me, you know, for the majority of the company's lifetime so far, the company and me were almost synonym to one another, right? The company is tiny. It's very much, if the company succeed, it's my success. If the company fails, it's my failure. So understanding that, there's more to it, than just that direct connection. And just making sure to leave time for other things that I like doing. It's not easy to do. But whether if it's exercising, taking some time off from time to time to travel, and just, you know, again, spending time with the family, friends, and community built around this is critical. So it's not like, I think the term work-life balance doesn't apply for startup founders as it does to even intensive careers. But there is a little bit of balance that you have to introduce into this because it's a marathon and you can't just sprint throughout 22 miles or whatever that is.
Yeah.
I don't run marathons.
You mentioned a few minutes ago, sort of the other topics or subjects that founders are, you know, like required to at least become somewhat familiar with, despite coming from maybe a more specific background. So like having come from a product management background, I'm curious sort of what's come easy for you, whether it's, you know, sales, marketing, managing a budget, et cetera, and what has been maybe more challenging to pick up as a skill set.
Yeah. So I see myself lucky to be, I think product management is a great background to come with because you understand the product side, the engineering side. I also have engineering background. So I understand the technology, and that's critical, especially we're solving a very technical problem with a very technical product, right? It's, you have to understand what that means. So I'm lucky enough to have that perspective covered. And I've also had the opportunity to work directly with customers in my previous roles, which with a lot of my, you know, fellow entrepreneurs coming from engineering, they didn't really have that experience of working with customers and understanding their concern, their problems, their pain points, and what does that mean? I think for me, it's not rocket science, but it does require a lot of learning and a lot of attention to details. Just the managing a company part, there's a lot of financial aspects to it and legal aspects. So just making sure you go into the details of what it means, like how do you read an investment contract and what's important, what's not important, stuff like that. So that was definitely part of that. And then from a go-to-market perspective, and I think that's where a lot of entrepreneurs with technical backgrounds struggle, is what does a good marketing function look like at this stage? How does a sales process look like? You know, back at Palo Networks, I was a part of the sales process up to a point, but then the procurement piece and the legal stuff and all of that were managed by other folks within the process. So understanding how that works and putting yourself in the customer's shoes, not just as it comes to solving the technical problem we're focused on, but also what does it mean to navigate that process within the organization? How does a budget look like? What does that mean for them for the next 6 months? What are different tools you can leverage to be able to work with them despite those factors? Are things that you really need to learn throughout the process. And when I say learn, it's both asking as many questions as possible and be very curious, but also go back and talk to people with more experience, whether if it's people I worked with back at Palo Alto Networks that had that visibility or other entrepreneurs that I can reach out to gain that full perspective of what is in the space of possibility. Sorry. And then, of course, most importantly, I made a mental note to mention it, but forgot, is bring people in that have that experience and that I trust. And I think, you know, kind of I focused on the first maybe year of the company where that wasn't still an option. But then, of course, throughout the last year, we were very, very fortunate to introduce some people into the company that are much better than I am in these on this subject. And I can learn from them and rely on them when it comes to these things.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit more about that. What have been some of the key hires you've made at this point, and how did you know it was the right time to make those hires?
So for us, it was mostly around, most of the company is still very much focused on building the product, right? We like to say that at this stage, at our size, basically we have two functions. You either build the product or you sell the product, right? That's everyone in the company are doing probably one of those two things. Building the product is usually where you start from, starting with the engineering focus that can help you build the first the basis of the product. So you can, going back to what I said before, you can start having organizations use the product, share their feedback, see whether or not the approach makes sense. And in the first stages of the company, most of the selling the product side is on the founders, and more specifically, usually the CEO. If there's another function that is not specifically engineering related, they might also be involved. For us as two founders, Asaf is very much focused on the technical side, and for me, it's everything else. So everything related to working with customers, whether if it's talking about the problem and understanding what's needed for them to deploy the product, was under my responsibilities. For me, at least, what came naturally to me is to start building the team by adding a couple of product managers that are doing an awesome job both in terms of managing the product development, but also in terms of working with our existing deployments, whether if it's existing customers or our POCs. Our product managers are still very much involved in that. I feel, you know, again, at these stages, if you don't have good alignment between what customers need and what you're building, then you might not be building the right thing. And as the company grows, you kind of have to add some functions in between those two. But as long as we can, we want to keep those two things as aligned as possible. So when it comes to teams that already work with us, the product managers do an amazing job doing that, actually working with those teams. And then the question becomes, how do you expand your reach? How do you get more folks to be working with you, ones that you haven't met personally, and so on? And that's where we started leaning more on Wild Ventures, but also bringing in more functions into the group, specifically marketing and sales oriented. So marketing is just to make sure, you know, as you expand your reach and meet organizations you've never met before, they don't know me, they don't know of the company, they're researching what it is that we do. You want to make sure you're putting the right message out there and the right content. And then from a sales perspective, just managing both the relationships and the scale of the amount of leads and prospects and customers we now have. You asked when do you know it's the right time? The right time is when you have no more time to manage it on your own, probably. So that was the right time for us to start understanding that, okay, it still is very much founder-led, but it can just be founder-based in terms of the capacity we have.
And what did you have sort of defined from a go-to-market or a sales process perspective before hiring, you know, for those roles? Did you have like a sales playbook and, you know, sort of a demand gen pipeline built, or what were sort of the infrastructure that you wanted to have before staffing?
Yeah, so I don't think we had a lot of infrastructure. We are still very much, I think this space in general, still very much in the trial and error, kind of understanding what's the right approach and who do you want to target first and what's the best go-to-market. And I think that actually says a lot about the type of people you want to bring in. You want to bring in people that are not afraid of changing things and are not, you know, it's not good or bad. It's just different stages of the company. It's if someone is looking for that very solid process, that very organized mechanism, that would be a problem. Like, we might have one now, but we might change it again in 2 months when we realize that some other things might work better. So I think that level of flexibility and agility is very important for the first hires on the go-to-market side. The second thing is you want to see at least the potential of them being able to grow with us, because even though that's important, obviously 6 months, a year, 2 years from now, we will be at the stage where we need more processes and we need more order to what we're doing. So you want to make sure that the same people can grow with you at least a couple of stages further. Not everyone can do everything. Like, when we become a public company, that might require different personas. But for those first early stages, you want to be able to have that flexibility. And then, of course, just being very creative with how do we approach things? How do we leverage our funds? How do we spend our time? There aren't a lot of resources at these stages. So you want to make sure that the people you bring in, the people we work with, can be creative in how do we approach this, you know, challenge of minimal resources, but obviously a significant challenge ahead of us.
Sure. And you mentioned just sort of operating with, you know, limited resources, given it's obviously still young and an early company and market. What have been some of the most like cost effective, whether it's tactics or techniques or just sort of generally things you guys have done that has been, materially impacted revenue?
Yeah. So I'll give two examples. And I think one of them starts with maybe just give a short context around the space we're in. So as I said, we are in the business of protecting data stored in cloud infrastructure. There are different ways of doing that, and there are different areas we chose to focus on in terms of how do we protect the data and what aspects of the data we protect. But the space of protecting data in the cloud that also got the nickname DSPM, Data Security Posture Management, is actually a pretty hot space these days. And as such, it actually gets a lot of attention even without our intentional processes around it. When someone asked me, are we concerned about competition? I told them, you know what? I actually prefer, I'm very lucky to be in a space where we have a handful of competitors. And I actually prefer that over being in a space where you're the only one trying to solve this problem. First, because it means that you might be wrong. If there's no additional validation, if no one else is doing what you're doing, is it worth doing to begin with? But also for your questions, it means that we have different teams out there helping us to establish this category. So, you know, whether if it's Gartner wouldn't have come up with a DSPM report called Innovation Insights if there was just one company working on this space. So maybe to answer your question more directly, the first thing we're doing is just being in the right space that gets a lot of attention from activities by multiple players and not just us. And I think that brings us to a state of mind of how do we leverage that activity to our specific benefit. We obviously want organizations to learn about DSPM and know what it is, but then we want them to come back to us when they are interested in starting a DSPM project or solving this problem. So I think that's just a way of thinking about this, of it's not just creating this category, it's leveraging the noise and attention it gets towards us. The second thing we're doing is we are, at this stage, it's very, very reliant on relationships. When you think about this, it's not like buying a product from a company that is well known and everyone, you know, it's a kind of a brand that you're familiar with. At our stage, it's very much about it's wanting to solve this problem and wanting to address this challenge within the organization as a security professional, of course. But it's also about the level of trust and confidence that you have in this company and the team you're working with. So building that relationship, building that level of trust is almost as important as building the right product. So our focus, our go-to-market approach has been very much focused on that. I'd much rather have an intimate dinner where I can actually meet the people I'm sitting with rather than having a booth in a conference where I'll give socks to 200 different people, but they might not be relevant for me. And again, this is just our approach at our stage of how we leverage our funds at the moment. You know, 2 years from now, obviously, we'd want to go towards a kind of a fishnet type of approach as opposed to the more dedicated one.
Yeah. And how do you go about doing that more targeted approach? Is that, you know, you're working with, you know, YL or other investors to get introductions and set up dinners, or what's kind of the tactics that you're deploying there?
So I think that the headline is whatever works. For us, it's again, it's I would say the most successful path is relationships, whether if it's our investors' relationships, my team's relationships, my relationships. That's the most cost-effective path, because if someone trusts, if there's already some level of trust, even if it's indirect, there's more openness to hear about what we're doing and working with us. So that's definitely step one. And then as you start building this network, you can start expanding based on it. So if we do have an intimate dinner, it's not just that we would only want to invite folks that we have some indirect or direct relationship with. We would also want to have our own customers be a part of that. So it's not just us telling a new security team about what we're doing. It's our customer telling them about what we're doing. So building those levels of trust is what we're focused on right now. It requires a lot of, you know, a lot of work with a team and with those ambassadors of ours. But if someone does come out of that, you know, if we do get introduced to someone out of that type of relationship, the chances of us actually being able to communicate what we're doing and to build that relationship towards an actual deployment and engagement is much higher than just a random lead.
Yeah, got it. Okay. Well, I'd love to pivot a little bit into, you know, maybe some broader questions about just sort of operating the business and maybe lessons that you guys have learned. What would you say are sort of the, what is maybe the biggest challenge or a couple of challenges that you guys are experiencing, you're experiencing today?
So I think, you know, the one thing that everyone are experiencing at this time is just what's going on with the market. There's a lot of instability with what we're seeing. And while we are not directly impacted by it, we are seeing many of the teams we work with have their budget cuts, have headcounts be reduced. So that's definitely a challenge. And when you think about, you know, what we're solving for is basically a new problem and a new space for many of the organizations we work with. It's not always easy to introduce a new budget line when budgets are being cut. I do feel like cybersecurity in general still remains a very strong, you know, even as budgets are being cut, cybersecurity is in comparison, less impacted than others, other parts of the business. But it is, you know, it creates sort of a let's hold, let's wait and see before we choose to move forward. For us specifically, I think it also creates an opportunity because I think the ROI of working with companies at our stage can sometimes be very significant. You don't have to spend as much, you know, as much of your budget as you would on a product that doesn't necessarily address your specific concern, as opposed to working with a company like us, where you can get more out of the relationship just because of the type of relationship. But it definitely creates some challenges and for our customers and therefore for us as well.
Yeah. I know there's a lot of cyber companies that kind of struggle with, you know, being perceived as sort of a nice to have versus a need to have. So I'm curious, as you're, you know, running a sales process yourself for, you know, coaching a go-to-market team member of yours on running their own sales process, like how it is that you would sort of position yourselves as more of a need to have and avoid the potential risk of being perceived as a nice to have.
Yeah. So I think, you know, it starts with the space we chose to operate in. Of what we were, you know, when I talked before about when you know, kind of about the space, many of the questions we were asking are about existing processes targeted to address the issues that we're solving for. You know, if something hurts and it's not painful enough for you to even go to the doctor or search about it over Google, then it's probably not that big of an issue, right? So the first thing you want to search for is whether or not they're already spending cycles, budgets on solving this problem from any other direction. So in our case, there were a lot of manual processes. There were a lot of kind of duct taping together different products to try and get to the same result. And that means that we can already tap into that time, effort, and budgets where they're already spending to improve those processes. The other edge of that, the other side of that coin is what would be the impact if they don't do that? And protecting data, there's a lot of what we do that also impacts and improves things like compliance and privacy and so on. And I think that's something that really resonates. So many of the organizations we work with understand what it means, you know, the fines of not being compliant, the fines associated with not being compliant or with violating regulations. And the other side of that is the benefit of being able to go through an audit and present that information to your customers. So we help them to protect themselves from losing money, but also maybe to help the business move forward by expanding the geographies in which they can operate with, the industries with which they can work. So that's definitely a part of that. And then something that, as you're asking about both, as we were talking both about budget, but also you were asking before about the things we were surprised to learn, there is an aspect to protecting data that is also relevant to removing data. So, you know, there's no better risk of protecting something than deciding you don't need it and removing it. And while we talked about this feature as a risk-oriented feature, and as time went by, we realized that the cost considerations of those features are becoming actually more relevant to some of the organizations we work with. So, you know, they might say, we love the product, but it'll be difficult for us to get it approved, to get the budget for it, and so on. And once the cost consideration comes into account, we can say, you know, by reducing the risk, you're actually also reducing the cost because you're now storing less data, or you pay for less seats in a seat-based product. And that actually helps them make the case around adding the product. So I do think that the economy has a significant portion of why that became such a significant part of what we kind of the value add we're providing.
Got it. Okay. So Eureka in that case could help say, you know, we could potentially reduce our risk exposure and reduce our costs by purging some amount of data. Yeah. And then that difference would be enough to justify purchasing Eureka.
Exactly. And kind of the combination of those cool. two things is either you help them understand it's something they need versus nice to have. But you know, need and nice to have, it's not like, it's not a Boolean answer, right? It's not yes or no. There is a spectrum to it. And it can help, you know, say it kind of tilts the weight towards awesome, we need it. And now we can also navigate the organizational decision-making process to help it lean towards our way. But I also want to say, maybe, you know, as we are talking about how do we convince or make sure we talk to organizations that need it versus think about it as nice to have. For some organizations, it is nice to have. I think Gartner projected that by 2024, about 25% of the organizations would have a DSPM, which is great. You know, it's up from zero that have it now to 25%. That's a huge market for us. But it also means that 75% of the organizations would not have a DSPM project, which means that for us, it's both around making sure that we talk about why is it a need to have versus a nice to have. But it also means that we need to be very quick at understanding when we meet a team that doesn't necessarily need it, that falls into those other 75%, and not spend a lot of cycles on it. So we talked about the team being small and the resources being scarce. Our focus and where we choose to spend our cycles is as important as making sure we identify those 25%.
Yeah. Very good. Well, I'd love to pivot into the rapid fire round. It's how I wrap up every interview here. So basic premise is I ask a few quick questions and you share whatever comes top of mind. Sound good?
Awesome.
Cool. So first one, what's your favorite book?
I haven't read for quite a while, but in the context of this conversation, The Hard Thing About Hard Things is definitely one of my favorites. And I keep going back to it whenever I face with some hard things.
Yeah. Who's someone in the cyber industry that you really admire?
So I still think very highly of my former manager back at Palo Alto Networks, Mike Jacobson. It's the dedication around focusing on the problem and what it is that we're doing is something that still helps me navigate the path even today.
Yeah. What's been your favorite thing about running Eureka thus far?
The team, definitely my team. The ability to choose who to work with and to be in the trenches all together has been an awesome ride.
If you could change one thing about the cyber industry, what would it be?
It's very, you know, I'm surprised we talked for 50 minutes and that didn't come up, but the cybersecurity industry is very male dominated. It is something that is changing slowly, but changing over time. And it's definitely something I would want to see changing faster. I would love to be able to spend more time with similar leaders in the space without waiting for the 20 years that would pass until we'll see an even split.
Yeah. And last one, if you could go back in time and get a drink with your 20-year-old self, what advice would you give her?
I'm trying to find the best way to phrase this. I am a very, I weigh every decision and I think about everything 10 times before I do it. I would tell her think about it three times less. And just enjoy the experience. I think at any point in time you think like this is the time where I make my career. This is the time where everything important happens, and there is plenty of time to do that. So that's hopefully what I would be able to tell her.
Very nice. Well, Liat, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today. Congratulations on all the success with Eureka thus far.
Thank you for having me.